A Mouthful of Air, a poetry podcast with Mark McGuinness.
Pregnant Teenager and Her Mama by Carrie Etter. You eat and eat and tremble. You tremble and eat, and your mother watches you like a mouse, a cat. She swoops in like a bat. You hope to be claimed. She alights beside you. Your hands turn palms up. Apology. Kangaroo, she plucks and drops you into the warmth of her pouch. What'll I do, you think? No need for speech. Her tongue's on your fur, or her love's your skin. The year's a crucible. And here she is, a doe who leads her fawn to water and waits. Oh, how she waits.
Carrie, where did this poem come from?
Well, I think it was about a year and a half ago now, maybe 2 years ago. I was working on Grief's Alphabet, the manuscript, and kind of pulling together these poems I'd been writing since my mother died in 2011. And when I started to think through what the manuscript needed to look like, you know, I had a lot of poems about the grief of her loss. But I realized as the manuscript came together that no one would understand what that loss meant to me unless I also portrayed my relationship with her and what she had been, what she meant to me as a mother, as my best friend, really. Mm-hmm. And so I had to write the opening section of the manuscript, which I call Origin Story, which is about our experiences together from the day I was adopted at 2 weeks old and all the way up to the last photograph I took of her and kind of my last physically recorded memory of her before she died a few months later, unexpectedly. So, of course, when I was thinking through that period of my relationship with her and important things we experienced together, one of the things, of course, that came up was my teenage pregnancy. Mm. And trying to recount, convey in a poem just how generous and supportive she was through that experience. I can imagine many another parent would have reacted very differently, but she was never anything but kind, supportive. She's the least judgmental person I think I've ever known. And I think having had her as having been adopted by her and my father is certainly one of the best things that ever happened to me. And it's part of the reason I turned out a poet to some extent, because they always supported whatever I did. And that included poetry from a very early age and short story writing as well.
Yeah, so that's another thing that poets are not always, you know, we're not always guaranteed support for poetry.
No, indeed. I've found very different reactions from different relatives and family members to my writing. But my mother was always, she was my first audience. She listened, you know, I ran to her with my poems as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old, 13-year-old. You know, she was the first person I took my poems to. And indeed, once I started getting published, I started, you know, I would send her, save contributor copies for her. That's, you know, for those of you who aren't poets, you may not realize that often we don't get paid for our poems, but we always get, if there is a physical magazine, you're always sent a kind of at least one copy, sometimes several copies of the magazine. So in fact, when I was in Illinois last month, I found, going through some old things, I found a huge tub of old contributors' copies I had given her over the years and forgotten about. And that, indeed, there is another poem in the manuscript, Grief's Alphabet, about writing my first poem and the kind of necessity of the completion of that poem in some ways, being running to and sharing it with her, as though the poem was not finished until I'd shared it with her. So there are a number of poems like Pregnant Teenager and Her Mama in Grief's Alphabet that record, you know, really difficult things like my father's layoff, his injury and death and so on that we went through together and that formed our relationship necessarily. You know, there were a lot of there are a lot of hardships. There are also some moments of joy, I should say, as well in the manuscript. Mm-hmm. And indeed, writing that first section, Origin Story, was in the end quite joyous because I understood even more keenly what I had in that relationship and how much it gave me.
And so she was your first reader. And, you know, a lot of writers talk about having an ideal reader in their head when they write. Would you say that she's a part of that ideal reader? I mean, maybe obviously in this collection, but what about other collections?
That's really interesting because as I've been working on the book I'm editing, Claire Crowther's Sense and Nonsense, I've realized that this collection is in some ways, perhaps both my most personal and my most accessible. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that I would always, and maybe that was partly because I had her in mind as one of my readers, that it turned out that way. That, and indeed my, you know, and then my next collection with a very different focus that I'm imagining, you know, is much less personal and perhaps would have a much different kind of approach to accessibility and the degree of linguistic and formal complexity, because I'm not imagining her as a reader in the same way as I am this book, as well as kind of imagining my family, who in the main do not read poetry unless they've been keeping it from me. I imagine that this is one that my sisters will actually open. They may come after me for saying that, but you know, I think my books kind of just stay on their shelves unopened for the most part. But hopefully this might be an exception.
Yeah, there are lots of ways to support a writer.
Yes, and then my family members kind of coming to my events and you know, showing interest in my work, and you know, sometimes they've had me come, you know, when my nieces and nephews were younger, they had me come and speak at their schools and things like that. And that's always really lovely. I love kind of, you know, taking poetry to young people in different ways.
And, you know, we're used, you know, any of us who've studied poetry, we're used to being advised to beware. If a poet says I in the poem, it doesn't necessarily mean the poet themselves is speaking. But this is kind of the opposite of that, because it's, the poem is saying you, but even before I'd read the rest of the collection, I kind of picked up that the you in this poem related to you, the writer.
there's something really wonderfully nimble about second person point of view, where you both allow, it invites any reader to step into the place of the addressee while at the same time being able to refer to a specific person. I think that's part of the power of the second person poems in Claudia Rankine's Citizen, that you invites us to experience what racial microaggressions are like for ourselves, even as we know we're not the you to whom this in fact happened.
And as the poem progresses, you kind of fades into the background, and we get she and her for the mother. And so by the end, it's the mother. And in fact, she's transformed into a doe as well. So there's that perspective shift as the poem goes on.
One of the things, one of the review endorsements for the book that particularly pleased me was one that noted that even though there's a lot of me in this book, I myself am not the focus. The focus is very much on trying to show who my mother was, trying to understand and appreciate who she was. And there's a line, in fact, at the end of one, another poem, lifelong, I daughter. And this book feels like an act of daughtering.
What a lovely functional shift.
But there is, I mean, I love all the, you mentioned the doe, and one of the pleasures of writing this poem was the use of simile and metaphor. Using, you know, playing with the figurative language and thinking of her as, and broadening her capacity in who she was by her adopting all these different animal identities that seem quite natural to her. And as I say that, my cat walks into the room.
I was just going to mention the cat.
Yeah, here he's squawking
so
for
got,
us.
You've got a mouse, a cat, a bat, a kangaroo, a doe, and the fawn.
It's quite a zoo, isn't it?
It is quite the zoo. You know, I mean, maybe you'd like to say something about that?
I am in awe of figurative language at its best. I think of phrases like Dylan Thomas's the wall.
Okay. Animals are welcome today.
Yes, indeed. Adding to our zoo. He uses the phrase a wall thin as a wren's bone.
Ooh.
Isn't that beautiful? Yeah. And I really wanted to play with that with this particular poem and do my best to make the figurative language work as well as I could to kind of suggest the breadth of her mothering, that it takes on all of these different qualities beyond the human, or broadens our sense of what the human is, perhaps.
I love that. And also what occurred to me when I was reading it was, this goes back to what you were saying about her lack of judgment, because humans are very good at judging teenage mothers. And yet all the natural imagery just kind of quite subtly suggests this is a natural process. You know, there's no judgment in the animal kingdom.
That's really a lovely insight. And indeed, yes, it's a way to kind of implicitly suggest the absence of judgment in her treatment, in her behavior. Well, that was not, I have to concede, part of my intention, but I love the fact that's part of the joy of readership, is the things that people find that work effectively in the poem that you weren't conscious of in its construction.
That's the magic of poetry, isn't it? You know, if it's a real poem, then there's always more in it, I think, than we're consciously aware of when we write. I guess another thing it picked up to me was, it signaled, was just the instinctive warmth and comfort. You know, she plucks and drops you into the warmth of her pouch. What could be nicer than that? and her tongue's on your fur. I mean, it's just, it's delightful, isn't it?
It is. She was the most, she was very physically affectionate in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Always kind of, you know, ready to long hugs, long, warm, soft hugs. That kind of, yeah, physical affection, easy to say, you know, quick to say, I love you as well. She's set a model for generosity and affection that continues to nourish me, even with the loss of her.
Well, that really, really comes across in this poem.
I'm so glad for that. I really hope to do her justice with the book.
And focusing just a little more on the form of the poem, I mean, how close is this to the original draft of the poem?
That's a really good question. I did take this to one of my workshop groups, and we raised some questions about the phrasing around the bat changed. It became a little bit clearer, but not a lot changed. I think one thing, so while I am devoted to revision and always trying to reach kind of the best version of my poems that I can. And I read them aloud over and over again, try to kind of, to make sure the language is working, to make sure the sound is working to the best of my ability. Sometimes I find that if an idea has stayed with me a long time before I draft it, then the poem, a finished poem, a poem close to finished comes out more easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's those poems where about an experience, you know, so many years ago now, I don't need to say how long it's been since I've been a teenager with my birthday later this month, but it's been some years. And I've often thought back to her handling of the revelation of my pregnancy and the way she came to me and the way we talked about it, and she, her gentleness and kind of quiet, steady support in that exchange, especially as you see pregnant teenagers represented on television and film and novels so differently. The kind of contrast showed me, you know, brought into relief what I had. And so I think that the fact that that memory is so strong and I've revisited it so often made this poem that little bit easier to get right in an earlier draft of the process. Other poems take 20 drafts. I think this was 3 or 4. But again, I think that's very much to do with how long the poem lived with me.
So I was about to say this poem had a long gestation, but then I realized what I was saying.
Indeed, it did have a long gestation.
Mysterious creative process. also, as well, I think it's probably true that your years of practice meant that it was relatively easy for you to draft it so quickly.
Some poems come... So the opening poem in the manuscript, Birthday as Adoption Day, about the day that... I was picked up from the hospital at 2 weeks old. I wrote at least 10 very different, completely different drafts of that poem.
Mm-hmm.
And because I couldn't get it right. I couldn't find the right use of kind of form and point of view that felt like that I got the right vehicle. And so that took a lot more redrafting. And then once I found the right kind of version, then even more tinkering after that. So it varies widely, poem to poem, how many drafts it takes, how much editing. I do run everything by, you know, I send the whole manuscript has read been read by a number of fellow poets. Mm-hmm. And I have two wonderful workshop groups, one in London I don't get to very often, and one here in the Southwest that I visit more regularly, that are great for feedback on my work, as well as a fiction workshop group as well. So I do a lot of workshopping.
And just looking a bit more closely at the opening, I mean, you've got so pregnant teenager and her mama. I mean, you put the pregnant teenager front and center there, which is bold and provocative for the reasons we've just discussed. But but you don't say and her mother, you say and her mama, which sounds much more homely and familiar. So you've got that kind of, it's almost inviting the judgment, but then the warmth coming right away.
I think that's really important, that sense that this is someone that if this pregnant teenager were to speak in this moment, that she would use something very familiar like that because of the intimacy of this exchange.
Yeah.
I have a lot of different names for my mother that come throughout the book. In fact, the most common one, the name I called her from when I was very little, was Maudie instead of Mommy. And Maudie comes up a lot in the book. But if you don't already, if you have the poem by itself, someone would see Maudie and not be sure whether I'm referring to a person's name or my mother. So it felt that I had to use Mama in this particular case so that you immediately read the title and you know what the relationship is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that warmth. It's like the whole poem in microcosm in the title. And then this wonderful opening where you've got so much repetition. You eat and eat and tremble. You tremble and eat. And your mother. That's the first two lines. We've got four ands, which beginners would be warned off. You've got eat repeated, tremble repeated, and you repeated. And yet, well, to me at least, it beautifully conveys that awkwardness and the helplessness of the teenager, that this, well, I'm doing this, and I'm doing, and I'm just, sorry, I'm raising my hands here. I can't see this folks on the podcast.
It's true. I was voracious during that time. In my first trimester, I was so hungry, and I was trying to kind of keep this pregnancy to myself. Yeah. And I was so scared because I really wasn't sure what to do. I believe in women's right to choose, and I felt that way then. I did consider abortion, but I decided to give my son up for adoption instead. Mm-hmm. And I'm very grateful. I don't judge anyone for making a different choice, but I'm very grateful for what I've done, not least because I now have a relationship with my son. As you may know from my book, Imagine Sons, which I wrote before I found him, you know, it was as painful as it was to give him up. I know I gave him a better life than I certainly could have provided at that stage in my life. And I certainly also didn't want to bring that kind of hardship onto my own family either. After all we'd been through, I mean, my father was still laid off at that point. And that was really not an option. So adoption ended up being the right thing for me at that time, but it's not something I would, you know, prescribe for anyone else.
Sure. Okay. And then we get, she swoops in like a bat. You hope to be claimed. She alights beside you. Sorry, I'm not reading it as beautifully as you do. And then your hands turn, palms up, apology. So it occurred to me that this is all gesture. There's no speech. And later on you say, what'll I do, you think? No need for speech. And again, this is the animal thing, isn't it? They don't speak, but they express through action and gesture.
Yeah, she, you know, comes and sits with me, and just from her posture and way of looking at me, I know there's no judgment coming. I know she's fully there to put her arms around me and hold me through this. I can't imagine, and I can't imagine what I needed more at that point than that love, that uncritical, unjudgmental love. The greatest thing that a parent can give to a child.
And then I think this is the only non-animal image in the poem, is when you say the year's a crucible. Which, I mean, so I'm thinking, we had Luke Palmer a couple of episodes ago, and he was talking about alchemy, and this is obviously an alchemical image of transformation. I mean, would you like to say anything about that?
Sure. I suppose, so in the midst of all of these animal images and the sense of this exchange within love, part of what makes that so powerful has been just how excruciating this experience has been for the speaker, for the you.
Yeah.
And so it kind of steps out and kind of provides a sense. You have context from pregnant teenager, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But the years of crucible kind of widens that out to, you know, being in high school and dealing with this, dealing with the father of this child, all of the hell that this experience has been. And so it's a way of a kind of intentional, kind of sharp contrast between the positive animal imagery and the difficulty of the experience. And so this moment is a kind of a haven amid the larger endurance of one of the most difficult things I ever experienced.
Yeah. And then it leads into this really, for me, beautifully judged ending. And here she is, a doe who leads her fawn to water and waits. Oh, how she waits. It's one of those endings that it's not tying things up in a little bow. It's not signaling too much to the reader, you know? I mean, in a sense, I was thinking, well, it's quite brave. You're kind of waiting for the reader to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a decision to make about that? Or did you just think, no, that's the ending?
No, although I have to say, I have read a wonderful essay by Joy Katz called Goodbye, Goodbye, Goodbye. I forget what comes after the colon, but it's basically on the use of repetition in poems and on the sense that we overuse repetition. And this is a poem where I really indulge in repetition, particularly at the beginning and the end of the poem. I love repetition. I tend to think poets don't do it enough.
It's one of the great joys of poetry, isn't it?
Maybe it's a difference between American and British contemporary poetry, but I tend to see, at least in my teaching, students underusing it.
In Britain, or?
Well, because Joy Katz is writing in an American context and quoting American poets over relying on repetition. I have not done. I'm probably going to get myself in trouble here, because I'm sure as soon as this goes out, people are going to be sending me all, you know, whole magazines where every poem uses repetition. that would be well deserved. But I really felt that power of repetition. The power of repetition at the beginning is to convey the tension, the nervousness of the speaker, caught in this cycle she can't break out of on her own, which is why she hopes to be claimed. There seems to be no way forward. And at the end, it's the loving patience of a mother who will simply sit and listen. And again, that sense of bring, you know, offering a kind of, you know, something, offering up a kind of nourishment that only she can provide, and simply waiting for the daughter to do the right thing for herself, whatever that turns out to be.
Yeah.
So, yes, I mean, there were, I think I had a version without the second, without the last line, but I was already working in tercets. So that might've been why, three line stanzas, I should say, why it felt incomplete. But I also wanted to pay attention to the fact that it's not just about what she did, but it's the way she did it, that how. The emphasis on, you know, not simply listening, but listening with a sense of complete lack of judgment and support, and calling attention to the rareness and specialness of that response.
Right. So just the patience.
That how she waits.
You know,
that waiting with a kind of care.
Yeah.
That waiting, you know, there's a way when people are in difficulty that simply being there can be nourishing.
Absolutely. Well, talking of repetition, I think it's time to hear the poem again. And Carrie, thank you so much for sharing so generously about such a powerful and personal poem.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy it's going to reach a wider audience. Pregnant Teenager and Her Mama by Carrie Etter. You eat and eat and tremble. You tremble and eat, and your mother watches you like a mouse, a cat. She swoops in like a bat. You hope to be claimed. She alights beside you. Your hands turn palms up. Apology. Kangaroo, she plucks and drops you into the warmth of her pouch. What'll I do, you think? No need for speech. Her tongue's on your fur, or her love's your skin. The year's a crucible. And here she is, a doe who leads her fawn to water and waits. Oh, how she waits.
Pregnant Teenager and Her Mama by Carrie Etter is from Grief's Alphabet, published by Seren Books. Originally from Normal, Illinois, Carrie Etter has lived in England since 2001 and teaches creative writing at the University of Bristol. Her poems have appeared in Boston Review, The New Republic, The New Statesman, The Penguin Book of the Prose Poem, Poetry Review, The Times Literary Supplement, and many other journals and anthologies internationally. Her fifth collection, Grief's Alphabet, is published by Seren Books. She also writes short stories, essays, and reviews. A Mouthful of Air is a poetry podcast hosted by Mark McGuinness. A new episode is released every month. If you enjoy the show and you would like to help me connect more poets with listeners and readers, you can contribute to the show's production costs at amouthfulofair.fm/support. You can also support our poets and publishers, as well as the podcast, by buying their books in the A Mouthful of Air bookshop at amouthfulofair.fm/bookshop. And if you would like a full transcript of every episode sent to you via email, you can sign up for this at amouthfulofair.fm/subscribe. A Mouthful of Air is produced by the 21st Century Creative, with music by Javier Weyler, sound production by Breaking Waves, and visual identity by Irene Hoffman. Thank you for listening. I'll be back soon with another poem. Thank you.